nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death.
Let's just start from the beginning and your name and rank and when you went to Iraq, just to start out with.
My name is Specialist Douglas Barber. I was with the 1480 Transportation Company, National Guard, out of Dover, Ohio. We were called to active duty on 11 February 2003, and then we actually got boots on the ground in Iraq. It was around the 1st of June of 2003 when we actually got into Iraq. We spent close to a month and a half to 2 months down in Kuwait.
So you actually didn't get through the initial invasion, but you got there when they were actually still real basic with the field services and stuff, right?
Correct, yeah. We were scheduled to go up with the 4th ID, but because the 4th ID didn't get routed through Turkey, we had to go down through Kuwait and wait for them to make a decision in Kuwait as to what they wanted to do with us.
Okay, and now, what were you actually trained for? What was your MOS?
My MOS was a 88 Mike, which is a transportation specialist, and how I got that was in my civilian career. I was a over-the-road truck driver, and I'd been out of the military for almost 10 years. I had re-enlisted in May of 2002, and in August of 2002, I was awarded the 88 Mike slot because of my civilian experience as a truck driver. So that's what my initial position was with the 88 Mike.
Okay, and while you were in Iraq, did they actually put you in a different assignment or a different job that would have been apart from your MOS?
No, we were operating as 88 Mike transportation specialist.
Okay, and how long did you train for, like actual combat training before deployment?
We trained for, it was 2 months, down in Fort Lee, Virginia, that's where we did our mobilization process. While we were going through our mobilization process, we did our what they call hip pocket training, which is basically going over tactics and skills, things of that nature. I mean, there is nothing that can ever prepare you for going into a war or into a combat position like what we went through when we finally hit boots on the ground in Iraq. There's just nothing to compare to that.
Okay. That was another thing I was going to ask you was, were you prepared for what you saw and experienced when you got to Iraq? I mean, you said there was no way to be ready, but I mean, did you have any idea what was even going to be, what it was going to be like?
No, we've seen while we were sitting at Fort Lee, we've seen pictures and we recounted the Jessica Lynch situation when she got, when she was POW. And things of that nature, I mean, we've seen that, but there was nothing, there's, when we left America, we were so much, we were innocent, I would say Iraq took away our innocence as far as what we've seen, what we went through, what we had to do, and the things that we were prepared to have to do in order to maintain our security and our level of protection, force protection with our unit.
Okay, now, when you actually saw combat and stuff, were you able to adapt to the combat as time went on, or did it just basically take you by surprise every time you had combat come up?
It was funny because, when we actually got into the combat, into the thick of it. See, we were stationed on LFA Anaconda, which is, if you know anything about it, that is right smack dab in the middle of the Sunni Triangle. And what we had to do, what our main job was to run missions between Anaconda never got prepared. You can never be prepared for what's going to happen. When there's an improvised explosive device that goes off, you can never be prepared for that. I mean, there's absolutely no way you can be prepared to be ambushed, you know. And every day when you go through your morning briefings before you depart your convoy, you know, they tell you the convoys that were hit the day before, the, you know, the soldiers that were killed, and as time went on, it just wore at your psyche. I mean, so it was a very hard thing to say that you could actually be prepared for what you would see or what you would hear.
Okay, now, this is something I've heard from a lot of soldiers that were over there. I mean, you saw civilians being killed. Do you have any idea how many you actually saw be killed or injured or anything like that? And how did that really affect you when you saw that?
I didn't see, you know, this. I didn't see any killed, but we heard about it on a daily basis. I mean, our unit, some guys in our unit had experienced they had experienced a situation to where they were ambushed and actually had to open fire upon these guys, and the guys in the unit that had to open fire, it really messed them up. We seen blood splatter on some of the walls down at the Baghdad International Airport. You know, of course, you would hear some of our own friendly fire from our helicopters would hurt the civilians and things like that, you know. So I never did have much exposure to it other than what we heard in our daily intel briefing. I can't really be of any good on that.
Okay. And I'm going to ask this, with the guys that you did see that had either killed civilians or fired, you know, and had idea that they killed a civilian, how did that really affect them? Did it mess their morale up on a day-to-day basis?
Oh, yeah, it shook them up pretty good. I mean, you know, even myself, I was hit with, my truck was hit with an improvised explosive device while on convoy down to Iraq, or down to Biop. And, you know, from that point on, actually, I would have to say the night that our company got hit with mortar attacks at the first part of July, it really changed our attitudes all the way around, that we, you know, we really did not like these people, you know, that we were giving them money and buying their goods and their wares and their supplies, and they were taking that money and going out and buying mortar rounds and mortar tubes and then turning around and lobbing them things at us at night while we were sleeping. And I had a situation where, you know, we were stuck in a traffic jam on our way down to Biop, and I had a lady take an older baby out in front of me, you know, like, well, I dare you to fire your weapon into this window, you know, and it just, that really messed with my mind, because I knew that, you know, if anybody produced any kind of a weapon of any sort out of that bus, that, you know, I was going to have to open fire upon that bus and take mama and baby and anybody else. You know, so that really messed with my mind. I know it messed with the guys, some of the guys that I was around and worked with, other guys that have been in war before. You know, it was just part of the job. But for those that had not been in war before, it was a tough pill to have to swallow.
Okay, now I'm sure you. How many soldiers did you see get killed or know of from the other units around you?
To start out with, in the month of July, we had, I think it was 18, 88 mics or transportation specialists get killed in the month of July. That was the hottest month as far as deaths for the 88 mics. And then on our base, we got mortared every night. Three, four, five mortar attacks, with each attack netting at least three mortars per attack, and I want to say at least seven. on a daily basis. Not only that, but when we would run our biop trips, we would come back, and I can remember on one occasion, within 10 minutes of us hitting the south gate, there had been an attack on another National Guard transportation unit, to where a soldier was hit by sniper fire from, I think they said it was 1,800 meters out. And they were, the soldiers on guard duty was asking us if we could see any snipers or any of that stuff. So it was the mortar attacks were a daily and nightly situation, and then anytime you leave the base, you were always up in the air because they would plant improvised explosive devices on the side of the road and animal carcasses and trash. They would make daisy chains out of bombs, out of the 155 howitzers. So it was death was all around you.
When you saw your fellow soldiers get wounded and killed or knew about them, how do you think that affected you on a short-term and then a long-term basis over time as it went on? You said a little bit about it, but, I mean, did that in itself affect your ability to perform your duty?
I believe it did eventually. It was always hard to hear when somebody in a unit on the base or whatnot. It was always hard to hear another soldier being killed or seriously injured. After a while, you take a nonchalant attitude to it because you can't be too careful because if you are, you'll make a mistake. But I have to say that yes, it was very hard, especially towards the last couple of months that I was in country, because it was you grew numb to the shelling and things of this nature, and it was just like, you can't do nothing more, and all you do is you hear about the death, and there's nothing more that you can do about it.
Okay. Now, just in general nature, do you think over time, you said you were performing in a diminished capacity, but I mean, in itself, how dangerous was that in regards to being able to be 100% while you were over there? Yeah, basically, like, over time with the general combat and stress, do you think over time you were performing at a diminished capacity, and what type of danger do you think that presented to your general unit's ability to perform their security operations? Do you think it was affecting your actual day-to-day duty operations?
Yeah, I know for myself, personally speaking, it greatly affected me because everything on the outward part of what it was that we were dealing with, we felt like POWs in our own country, because we weren't allowed to leave. We weren't allowed to leave the compound. So, you're sitting on a compound that is obviously, and even to this day, a sitting duck, so to speak. For these hardliners that don't want to give up Iraq and want to maintain their ideas and their way of thinking and whatnot, it greatly affected my mental status and how I performed. I got to a point that I could really care less about these Iraqis, and I really, when I come home and started hearing, about the beheadings of these American contractors and things of this nature, and I seen the torture pictures from Abu Ghraib, a part of me deep down inside was like, I think that we need to do more of that. They're the Iraqis are making a public enemy out of us, and mocking attacking us by beheading our people, you know, and yet we're playing political games with them by, you know, hey, you know, we've got to be this way or we've got to be that way because of the torture that our people are doing to these Iraqis. And it's just like deep down, part of me said, you know, we need to do more humiliation of them folks because of what they're doing to us. I mean, they don't care about us being over there. You know, there's a general population does, but the terrorists, they don't care about us. But yeah, my attitude, it greatly diminished. And even still to this day, you know, I can really care less about what happens. I mean, I can really care less about what happens over there. So yes, my day-to-day routine was dramatically changed.
Okay, you had said that last night when I talked to you about feeling like a POW of your own country. I mean, I really want you to get into that. I mean, can you explain that a little bit more?
Well, you know, we're fixing to go into an area of politics that, you know, it's when I say I feel like a prisoner of our own country, POW of our own country. It's like, you know, we were in an area that was I think 10 square miles around, and we had commanders on the field over there that had their heads so far up their hideys that they didn't know what they were doing. I mean, you know, us lower people in the Spec 4s and E5s, E6s and whatnot, you know, we're listening to some of the decisions that the field commanders were making. You know, it was like, you know, taking a combat post and turning it into a garrison post. In other words, you know, we're supposed to have the military has a thing that's called a heat cat category. It runs from anywhere between 1 and 5, with 5 being the worst regarding, you know, the heat that is outside. Normally, whenever you have a heat cat 5, which is temperatures of, I think, 90 or better, you're supposed to be able to walk around with your boots under, your pants unbloused, and things of this nature. Well, they were trying to make it a garrison post by telling us we need to blouse our boots, we needed to have our skirts rolled down and tightly wound up and stuff like this, you know, and we're in the middle of 140-degree temperatures, 150-degree temperatures, and we got guys that are dropping out left and right from heat exhaustion. And it's like, you know, you guys don't even understand, you know, that this is not a garrison post out in the middle of the desert. You know, and the commanders just, they don't want to see that. They don't, they're making decisions about, you know, okay, well, they kept on telling us that when Kellogg Brown and Root was coming in to take over the day-to-day operations, well, you know, initially, when they said, okay, well, Kellogg Brown and Root's going to come in October. Well, once Kellogg Brown and Root comes in, then we're going to be able to go home. That's, you know, October 2003, we were going to start heading home once Kellogg Brown and Root come in. Well, the commander kept on saying, well, you know, that's scheduled to change. Whenever they come in, then we're going home. Well, when the date come around for us to go home, it never happened. We got extended out for 1 year. It was 1 year total. We had to sit around and do nothing. I mean, we had so many transportation units that were part of that had come up from Iraq or come up from Kuwait that was activated. They were sitting around doing nothing. I mean, we were pulling MP duty. And this is why I'm saying, you know, we were POWs of our own country because, you know, we were sitting here running MP missions, and we're 88 mics. We're supposed to go out here and run up and down the MSRs protecting the KPR convoys, and we're not and doing an MP's job, and we're not even MP's.
So you guys were force protection for the KBR convoys after they came in. Not even a military job. You guys were escorting the KBR guys.
Yeah. I mean, we were escorting, and the KBR guys, they weren't allowed to carry firearms. So you would have a 30 to 40 truck contingent of KBR trucks, and you would have maybe 5, 6, or 7 military vehicles with an, on an average of 2 to 3 people per vehicle. So, you know, you don't have a very good military support group. You've got quartermasters that were running military operations or MP positions. You had cooks out manning guns going up and down the MSRs. You had, you name it, logistical support personnel that their jobs were to take care of personnel and getting people from here to there. Well, instead, they were being sent out on convoys to defend these KBR convoys going up towards Tikrit and some of these other places down into Baghdad and the whole nine yards, you know. So we were being used as MDs instead of 88 mics.
Yeah, I've heard that from quite a few transportation people that, you know, and you guys are supposed to be the combat support people. Your technical duty means that you are in the rear and, you know, making sure that the convoys get through to the front. And yet, from what I've heard from a couple other transportation companies, that was the least bit of concern for them most of the time.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're running, my unit was a 931 medium combat or a light combat unit, which we were pulling 33-foot flatbeds, hauling Air Force pallets from BIOP up to LSA Anaconda and points north, and, you know, we were running these missions. Now, let me tell you, as a transportation specialist, you know, one of the things that Bush said that we were going to be doing while we were over there was, you know, we're going to be providing humanitarian support for the Iraqis.
Right.
Well, the entire time that I was over there, not one time did I see a load of humanitarian aid being trucked in from anywhere for the Iraqis.
Yeah, I was watching the press conference the other day, and they were asking, I think it was the 56th Brigade Combat Team who does the transportation, Texas National Guard, and they were asking the colonel, what type of commodities are you running? And he kept saying, supplies. And they said 3 or 4 times, is it humanitarian food or anything else? And he had no answer for that. So basically, you guys were not doing what the mission profile was supposed to be at all then with the humanitarian support.
Well, see, that was the joke because, you know, we sit there and, you know, we would ask, you know, what is our mission? What specifically, you know, is our mission? You know, we would, you know, I would see, 915 units, which are primarily meant for hardball running. That's long-haul running from, say, from Baghdad down to Kuwait. You know, our unit was meant to be a actual desert unit, was to be able to go out into the desert, things like that, because that's the way we were set up.
Okay.
We had PLS units out there that they were designed to be hauling supplies around or whatever else. Now, not one load did we pull, and then any other load that we see coming up out of Iraq on hockey trucks or on our trucks, on American trucks, not one load that I see contain humanitarian supplies for the soldiers. Now, here's another thing that I want to debunk while we're at it. You know, the soldiers are doing a great job over there. You know, they're doing, you know, humanitarian supplies. The individual soldiers and the individual companies are the ones that are doing the supplies or doing for the Iraqi people.
Okay.
The government itself is not doing that because we even did it with our unit. Let me give you an example of this. We had Iraqis come in and do work for our company. They would come in and they would make sidewalks. They'd clean up the AO. They would help us do certain things, you know, and whatnot. Well, we pay them $5 a day, a bag of MRE, and a bottle of water, and shoot, they felt like they were $1 million, that they just got paid $1 million. And that was the idea of humanitarian supplies and the things that we would give them. You know, we'd give them things but then they turn around and whenever they got found out they were working for the United States, somebody that didn't like that idea Iraqis weren't getting humanitarian supplies, we didn't see the Red Cross running up and down the roads like everybody had said. When the Red Cross building had got bombed in August, Red Cross pulled completely out of there. So there was definitely no humanitarian support coming in. All it was that we were seeing was parts. We were seeing clothes, MREs being trucked in, water being trucked in. They were rebuilding. They were using their own supplies locally to rebuild. But, he didn't see humanitarian supplies coming in there except for by the individual units that wanted to do something.
Yeah, and I've heard that from a lot of guys that have been over there, that they were doing like the log cap missions, going around and doing the med cap and stuff like that. It was almost like they had to pull that duty on their own or make a big issue to even do that. And, I've heard that, and also I've heard the dismay of after you go and do, one humanitarian mission or two humanitarian missions, a bomb goes off and the next thing you know, they've got 10 guys trying to attack you the next day, just in general retaliation.
Yeah. I mean, for the biggest faction, I would have to say that the Iraqi people love for us to be there. I mean, the Iraqi people themselves love for us to be there, but it was hard to, it was hard to know who to trust, because the very same people, like I said, we would go out, we'd have these, what we call these little hachi marks on the side of the road as we left base. We had these little stands set up, all the way down the highway, that these guys would sell bayonets, they would sell cartons of cigarettes for $5 a carton, American-made Pepsi, cases of Pepsi, Glossolite, things like this. They would sell that kind of stuff on the side of the road. Well, then that night, we were wound up getting mortared left and right, so you didn't know who to trust and who not to trust when you were trying to help these people out, but who was it that you were actually helping out? Was it the people themselves, the Iraqis themselves, or was it the Fedayeen? I mean, we had the Fedayeen working in our own laundry facility, and they were taking our female clothes, they would take their bras, their underwear, and, they would try to use our own stuff against us. Shoot, we had the Iraqis making improvised explosive devices right on our own base,
mm-hmm.
Putting them on the front steps of our PX, putting them on the main thoroughfare going through base, and all kinds of stuff. And it was like, you're trying to help these people out, but then they're turning around and they're taking your stuff and doing this and doing that. It's like, who do you trust? You can't trust anybody. You can't trust these people.
And that kind of leads to even greater incidences of combat stress, and you have that idea that you can never ever relax over there. Did that really impact on your mental well-being?
Oh yeah, it was. I will have to say that I am more aware of my surroundings now than I ever have been. I have learned to listen more than to watch. To look and see what's around me. I'm always on alert. We faced a constant bombardment of mortar attacks and Chinese rocket attacks while we were over in Iraq, and that's just why we were mobile on the or set stationary on the base, so that doesn't include the attacks that we would, that we would experience while we were on convoy going south and or north either way. And it was just, it was a very hard thing to have to deal with. I mean, you felt like, you literally felt like you were a sitting duck. And we would sit there around the base and we would watch the Blackhawks go up and the gunships go up in complete darkness and watch them patrol the outer perimeter. But it wasn't enough. I mean, we would be in tents that had sandbags that were 2 foot high, and yet we would have these mortar attacks, and you would literally lay in your cot, and you could hear the mortar, the mortars, and you could just about, tell where they were landing, if it was, up by the CSH Command Support Hospital, or if they were landed by the defects or whatnot. You know, you never felt like you could actually get any sleep. And it was many a night where you didn't go to sleep, you know, and or if you did go to sleep, you wondered if, you know, you were going to wake up the next morning.
Right.
And it was a very, very difficult to experience that. And I know when I first got home, the very first day I got home, my ex-wife and I, we were out at a restaurant, and a balloon popped. And no sooner had that balloon pop, I was literally underneath of the table because it, you know, it was just, I was so jumpy, and I'm still jumpy today. I'm still jumpy from you know, just about any little noise or whatever else, and I don't sleep as well as I used to.
Okay, now, I'm going to get into that a little bit later, but you were extended, right, during your time in Iraq. Is that correct?
Yes, we were extended at least twice.
Okay, now, do you think that affected your morale and the guys around you, knowing that you didn't have a set return date?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, we're a National Guard unit now. Now, granted, you know, we know that when we sign up, you know, when you sign up for the dotted line, you know, war comes, you're going, you know. And you know, we as a National Guard unit had a common joke while we were over there. It was like, you know, 2 weeks a year, you know, my butt, you know, quote unquote, was 2 weeks a year. My ass was basically how it
saw that in the Transco truck that that picture's been around the world. I've used it on a website a couple times, and you know that showed the sentiment of the National Guard guys within, you know, with one picture. And I think that was September of 2003. I think that was might have been your company or your unit. That was out of LSA Anaconda.
Yeah, it was one of us. I know we had it taped up on the door, you know, of our RAO up there. We're National Guard unit, and you know we're not expected to be, you know, be gone away from home for a year at a time, you know. And in all actuality, that unit as a whole was gone for longer than that because they were activated on February 2003. They didn't deactivate, I believe it was, until April or May of 2004. So they were literally 1 year on the ground overseas, and then not including all the time that they had, you know, for training time and all this other stuff, you know. So, you know, we're sitting there thinking, you know, well, hey, you know, we're being extended out. We're being told at one point, you know, hey, well, you guys are going to get to go home as soon as KBR comes in and gets up running. Well, they turn around and said, no, you're not going to go home, and we don't really have a purpose, you know. Even when KBR did come in and get up and get running, things started slowing down for us. So it was like, you know, well, hey, what is our job here? What are we doing? Why are we even here when we have more transportation units that are sitting around doing nothing? What are we doing? Why are we even doing it? So yeah, it really hurt the morale of the unit. And I'm going to tell you this. Is that, you know, these commanders, and I'm real hot and heavy on them. You know, you see these guys come on the news all the time. You know, they say, oh, well, yeah, hey, the morale's great over here. Or, you know, the guy says great, you know, and, you know, we're all happy and we're doing fine and we're all down low. Look at the rank for the most part on their shoulders. They're captains, they're majors, they're lieutenant colonel.
Right.
They might be senior NCOs or whatever else. But get down to, you'll never see a genuine interview of a lower enlisted soldier with a bad attitude. Somebody that has something to say. You will never see a soldier with that kind of an attitude being interviewed because they don't want that to get out. They don't want the bad publicity of the morale getting out into the news stream, you know, because the American population thinks, oh, well, things are going good, you know, the soldiers are happy and na-na-na and all this other stuff. Well, ask soldiers for letters, ask the families of soldiers for letters that are being sent back home from, you know, from what they're doing and whatnot, you know, and look at what's being said online and
right.
All this other stuff, you know, ask these soldiers, and you're going to find out that the morale is not that great in Iraq, not like the president says, you know, not like his bootlicking groupie have to say, you know, that things are going good. It's not going good.
Okay, and I've been getting some letters from various soldiers and talking to them either when they came back on leave or when they had, you know, come back home. And that was the situation that kept telling me that the actual general morale above, under, like, E6 was just absolutely crappy. And I even had a colonel tell me, even in Vietnam, he didn't see that level of morale drop that quick. I'm going to get on to another question, though. Now, when you were over there, did you report symptoms of combat stress or PTSD?
Oh, yeah, I tried to take it to my chain of command. See, we had a combat lifesavers that were trained in the combat staff, and our unit wasn't prepared for any of the combat stress. Our unit would not take steps to identify and deal with the combat stress. They were, you know, they would leave it like it is. You know, they take it if a particular soldier or group of soldiers or hit with an IED or had some kind of a direct attack on them, they take them off the road for a few days, let them get their bearings back, and then stick them back out there again, and they wouldn't even deal with it. You know, they wouldn't even deal with it. Well, I had to go to a combat stress clinic, and that was the only way that I was able to be identified as having any kind of combat stress was going by the combat stress clinic in order to get any kind of help at all, you know, anger management or whatever the case might be, and that's what I got while I was over there was a little bit of counseling, but that was primarily it, you know. So
that's 3 days, is that not correct? They give you like 3 days of Okay, so there's just basically from what you saw. I mean, now when you reported the combat stress, what was the attitude? Was it pretty negative? How were you treated afterwards?
No, it was negative. I mean, for certain. I mean, if you rock the boat in any kind of way, you know, and reporting combat stress, if you rock the boat in any way, you were immediately branded for the most part. You know, that you were going to be trouble or whatever the case was. You know, so a lot of guys would say, you know, that they didn't want to report anything because they were afraid of the retaliation that would come back off of it. You know, so. Went on about day-to-day business and then just stuffed everything inside and said to heck with it.
Yeah, I've heard a term for that, and it's called FIDO, F it and drive on. I mean, I've heard guys tell me that. You know, is that the general prevalent attitude with the PTSD, with the guys you saw?
Yeah, that was it. Because that was our platoon motto, was FIDO. And, you know, we were, that's what we had to deal with.
Okay, now, how many soldiers did you see or serve with who were suffering from combat stress or at least exhibiting some type of psychological problems, and were they willing to admit it? You pretty much said no, but, I mean, did you see a lot?
Oh, I've seen a lot of soldiers with combat stress. I mean, you know, we had situations where, you know, I had two E5s lock and load their weapons and point them at each other just before we pull out on a convoy one day. 17 soldiers in Iraq killed themselves, including officers with their own weapons. I mean, we had to go through suicide counseling from our battalion chaplain, and anybody in Iraq was going through suicide counseling because, you know, the stress was at such a magnitude level over there. A person in the general population cannot imagine exactly what the toll is like over there for the soldiers that are there or have been there. I mean, it's phenomenal. I mean, I knew of another situation of a soldier that had a squad automatic weapon. You know, he had locked and loaded, sit on the front steps of the battalion at home, and was ready to shoot everybody from the battalion commander on down. I mean, that was the type of attitude, and there was so many of that going on. There was so much of that going on in Iraq, but those are stories that you don't hear being told back here in the news.
said, were there a lot of incidences, and I've heard this, but I mean, you said the guy was sitting there locked and loaded. Was there incidents of that nature where they were upset with their officer and were at the point of violence or killing someone?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was a regular occurrence. I know on our base alone, that was a regular occurrence. I mean, there was, a situation of old boy that had threw a grenade into the tent of his captain and a couple other officers just prior to going up into Iraq. I mean, I know that was a wild incident, but while we were up there, I mean, there was a lot of that stuff that was going on. I mean, that's stuff that you're not even going to hear about until these guys start coming home. And, I'm basically that first round to come home. It's almost 2 years later, so you're not going to start hearing a lot of that over the next couple of years.
Yeah, I figure within the next year, this is going to be, a really large issue. It's going to be too large to ignore, but it seems like right now, they've done a lot of general press coverage, but the actual guys like you speaking out has been really rare and far between, in my opinion. And, this is another thing I want to add. I'm going to get on with some of these questions. What types of problems are you experiencing now that you've returned home? And, how is it affecting you in regards to your daily life?
Problems I'm facing now is shortly after I returned back from home, my 11-year marriage I had with my wife had disintegrated to the point that we're currently in a divorce. I suffer from a lot of flashbacks, a lot of anger, bitterness, severe deep depression. I'm taking probably 8 different medications for pain in my body, from anywhere from carpal tunnel. Of course, the PTSD is the biggest thing right now, and dealing with learning how to cope with what's going on. My financial situation is just—it's terrible. I had lost everything, financially, and so far in debt that I can't even begin to start trying to climb out of it right now. And all I can do is avoid the bill collectors because I don't know what to tell them. I'm living on $363 a month. I've had 6 jobs since I've come back home from Iraq and camp. My interpersonal skills with people, I can't be with other people. I can't be around other people. I get out into the public. I can't stand being closed up, being around a lot of people, things of that nature. I'm always watching. If I see a foreigner, I'm even more on the guard, watching those foreigners. And it's been really, really, really tough to maintain and to keep myself up and to keep myself going.
Okay, and what type of counseling and treatment are you getting right now?
Well, I know I'm in a post-traumatic stress disorder group that meets every 2 weeks down here in Columbus, Georgia. I got a doctor's appointment that I see about once every 5 months, a psychiatrist that I get to see about once every 5 months that deals with my medications and things like that. Outside of that, that's it. I don't get a chance to talk to anybody. I don't get no other one-on-one counseling or any of that stuff.
And have you had problems even getting the counseling you have right now? Has there been any problems with that?
Yeah, I had to physically go get myself checked in with the help of the DAV back in April just to get some kind of help. And then trying to get appointments is like pulling teeth. You get an appointment and sometimes a month and a half or 2 months out, that doesn't help you right then to where you got these murderous ideologies or whatever the case might be. It just doesn't help right then.
Right. Now, situations a lot of times. Is that correct?
Oh yeah, I still believe, you know, I still maintain the level of battle awareness, but it's a very high situation. I'm always watching what's going on around me. I always maintain that level of security. I keep my mind on it at all times. I don't ever back off of it. Anybody that I'm around, I'm always watching out after them and things of that nature. You know, even if it's somebody I don't know, I'm always watching for their well-being as well.
Okay, now when you were getting ready to come back home from Iraq, or at any time during your tour, or when you got back, was PTSD and treatment and counseling options discussed, and do you think there was enough effort made to inform the soldiers about PTSD and treatment?
No, there wasn't. I didn't even know what PTSD was until I come back home from Iraq, and that was probably 3 or 4 months after I come back from Iraq that I even heard the term, and then it wasn't until probably November of last year that I really started finding out what PTSD was all about. Actually, I've got to tell you the truth, I believe it was April of this year to where I really started learning what PTSD was all about and actually started to deal with it. I don't think it was until this year. So, no, it wasn't something that was brought up.
Now, what do you think needs to be done right now? What would you see change with the program when you come back from Iraq or even over there? What kind of counseling would you think they need to put in over there coming back?
There needs to be, you know, they call it a decompression time, you know, but, you know, it's like I've been talking with a lot of individuals that have PTSD and some folks don't even know that they have it. Like I know myself, I didn't really realize I had anything. I just knew that the longer I was at home, the worse that I got. I just beat myself. I just kept on slipping down the slope until I finally get a point to where I was just something had to give, or else, you know, I was going to give one of the two. You know, so they were saying that PTSD is one of them things that can come on out of the clear blue and you not know what it is till it actually hits you. You don't know what the signs are. So I think more awareness needs to be given to it. I think that the soldiers need to, the military itself as a whole needs to put more of an emphasis on the PTSD and making the soldiers aware of it when they come back home. I don't know what they're doing now, but I know when I come back home there was no awareness of it at all, other than just the decompression.
So, yeah, and that's one thing I've seen the military even admit, that with an active duty unit, they have a couple weeks when they come back to go through all this stuff, but if you're a National Guardsman, you're going to go right back home and you might be 100, 200 miles away from your actual armory, and you're on your own out there.
Yeah, well, that's the typical, I mean, that's the thing. I know, like, for myself, you know, being a National Guard or being a reservist, you know, so many families were put in a bad financial situation, and, you know, I know when I come back home from Iraq, I realized, you know, hey, we were in pretty bad financial dire straits, so I went back to work as a truck driver, and I'm telling you, I fought it. I wasn't ready to get back in the truck. I was not ready to get back in the truck at all, but I had to. I had to get back into the truck, so I had to stuff my feelings away to do that. So it's very hard for a National Guardsman or a reservist to deal with their issues when, you know, they got to get back to their everyday life and their everyday routine because, hey, their family's waiting on them to come back home. You know, the communities are waiting on them to come back home.
Right.
And to do what needs to be done.
Let's see. are you still able to be called up right now? Could you be called back for another tour?
No, I'm totally out. I was actually totally discharged out last year. I was basically blackballed out of the military, so I'm totally done. I'm totally out, and I can't be brought back in.
Now, you did put, you had talked to me about this before, you put an 8-page letter in, and that was what kind of got you in some serious trouble. Can you go into some details about that?
Yeah, I had, during the course of my time with being with this agency, I had volunteered to be transferred over from my unit to the unit that I went to Iraq with, and during the course of that time, there had been some severe run-ins with my chain of command. Well, two of the biggest issues in Iraq was breaking theater policy. And theater policy is you're not supposed to have any pornography and you're not supposed to have any alcohol of any kind over in Iraq because it violates the Iraqi beliefs and the Muslim beliefs and stuff of that nature. Well, as part of, I had went and filed an 8-page sworn statement talking about the sexual misconduct that was going on amongst the senior enlisted with lower enlisted females and males that were married to not each other but to other individuals, breaking the fraternization rules of the military and basically the honor code. And as a result, I had went and filed an 8-page sworn statement against my unit about stuff that they were stealing from their own personal use. I kept track of this. There's plenty of witnesses that knew what was going on in the unit. That if my female first sergeant, she had taken out the females that were under the age of being able to drink, took them out, just got slammed drunk, even though they were under the age of drinking, and turned around and got busted herself for a DUI, but got it swept underneath the table, and proceeded to tell everybody else the following day that, you know, if that would have been any one of us, that the military police would have slapped us on the hand, or actually would have thrown the book at us, and, you know, made us suffer through the entire legal process and everything else if we got busted for a DUI like she had. But she got slapped on the hand and walked away from it. And so that was all part of everything that was going on. If you're talking about the morale, we had what was called unit climate profiles that were done, and what it basically does is it critiques the leadership. You know, what the lower enlisted have to say about the leadership and things of this nature. But we had two of these unit climate profiles that were conducted, and they were so bad, but yet the unit climate profiles just come up missing. We don't know where they went. We don't have any clue of where they went and any of this stuff. So these were all things that I had put in that 8-page sworn statement. Well, after I had put this in the 8-page sworn statement, there was an Article 15-6 investigation that was conducted by 3rd COMCOM, and Brigadier General Vincent Bowles had ordered it. I was told by the chaplain of the 413 Quartermaster Battalion out of New York that if any of the allegations that popped up weren't true or any of this other nature, it was going to look bad on me, that they were going to bring me up on charges, that they were going to reduce me in rank and reduce me in pay. Well, guess what? It come back into my favor. They didn't know what to do with me. They didn't call any of the witnesses that I had listed down on the piece of paper to be called that would verify it to a lot of the stuff that had happened and things of this nature. And so I had, you know, when we were going through this investigation, it was like, you know, I should have been put back into the unit according to the Inspector General's office and the 3rd IG or the 3rd COMCOM. I shouldn't have been put back into the unit because of the scope of it. There was another female in my unit that was done the exact same way by our unit, that they were blackballed. She was blackballed out because she reported the sexual misbehavior, the pornography, and the whole nine yards. And there was another male in another company under the same battalion that had filed charges against women sworn statement was put back into the unit. I had sent a letter home or an email home to my wife telling my wife, I said, I could see why there was 18 or 17 people that have killed themselves in Iraq because of the change of command and the things that are going on over here that is not getting out. Well, that ultimately got me put into the combat surgical hospital or the combat stress clinic for the second time. And then at that point, they had put me out on a personality disorder, left me in a tactical operations center for 30 days with unsecured weapons and ammo when I was supposed to have been suicidal and homicidal.
Ah, that's wonderful. You got a lot of the Army.
The
letter home, now I've heard this from soldiers and I've had this happen with a couple other ones. The letter home saying how it was got you in some serious trouble, is that correct?
Yeah, the letter that I eventually had wrote home to my wife was while we were in Kuwait, and that's where I was listing off to where my female first sergeant was having sex with a lower E5 who was married, and I wasn't the only one that was writing letters home describing the stuff that was going on. I mean, my own company commander, and I don't know what he meant by it, but my own company commander had told me that he was more worried about sex for services going on in his unit than he was worried about a first sergeant pulling a specialist out of bed at 1:30 in the morning and being harassed. I mean, he just point blank told me this, and I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, my God, you know, you're more worried about, you know, covering your butt than you are about, you know, another one of your soldiers is having a problem. And, you know, so that kind of stuff was going on. You know, and here's the thing is, I was told that when you're in a position of power, such as a first sergeant, an E7, you know, an E6, or whatever the case might be, whenever you're in a position of power, you're going to get away with anything that you can get away with. And that's exactly what I was told. Is that, if you know how to work the system, you're going to allow me to work the system. And I've seen it firsthand where there were E6s and E7s that were allowed to go home on emergency leave for stupid little things, but yet somebody who really needed to go home on an emergency leave was made to jump through hoops in order to be able to be let out of the theater. And that's what's going on now. Is you've got soldiers who literally need to come home for emergency leave purposes, but because they don't know how to work the system, they're being made to jump through hoops. But somebody who does know how to work the system gets to go home right away, and you know, they get to abuse the system, but then the lower folks, they just get squatted on. And that was a big issue, and it still is a big issue.
Now, when you were over there, did you see anybody being punished for telling the truth, sending reports back home? I know some guys have been in trouble for doing the blogs and everything, too.
Well, one of the big things was that, you know, we were not, you know, we had guys that had their own laptops, and they would communicate back home, you know, whenever a roadside bomb would go off or something like that, you know. We were always getting in trouble for letting information get out back home to the families and whatnot. I knew of situations, where there were people that were letting out operational security stuff to the families back home and whatnot, and the chain of command from way high up, all the way from 5 Corps all the way down, would say, hey, look, you know, we're going to put a stop on this communication stuff, but y'all don't stop telling people what's going on, you know, here and back home, you know, telling people back home what's going on. I even had an NCO threaten to take my laptop away from me when I was trying to communicate with one of my former battalion commanders. They threatened to take my laptop away from me. And I said, no, that's personal property.
So there was a general state of don't tell people at home what's going on here. You know, I mean, I've heard this, but I mean, that was a big deal over there to tell, not to tell people at home what was going on.
Oh, yeah, they were, you know, that's what I didn't understand about it, you know, is that, you know, mail was supposed to have been censored. you know, they were opening up our mail, they were looking at our pictures, you know, to make sure that, you know, we weren't sending pictures home that shouldn't have been sent home. There was reports of mail that was being opened and things were being confiscated out of it. Yeah, there was a big push on that all the way through the entire time I was there, of them saying, hey, look, you know, you guys aren't allowed to say these things, you know, you guys gotta be quiet and stuff. And that's another thing that falls under that DOW attitude of your own country, you know, because you know, you're in the military, they say, oh, well, you don't have any rights. Well, hello, does that mean that, you know, I'm in the military, does that mean that I don't have any more constitutional rights?
Yeah, you're fighting for our freedom. I hear that all the time. You guys are fighting for my freedom over here.
And I'll tell you furthermore, you know, I'm going to come back here and I'm going to say, look, you know, I volunteered above and beyond I had signed up after being out for 10 years to come back in and volunteered above and beyond to go back overseas. You know, my career as a civilian truck driver, I have a hazardous materials endorsement on my license. I come back home, and now I have to be fingerprinted. I have to take all this documentation, all this evidence, the Department of Homeland Security is going to check my background and the whole nine yards. Yet I'm an American soldier that served in a foreign country, and I am still a hazardous or I am still a threat to national security, because there are things that I know that about the base and the procedures and things of this nature, you know, that if I ever got online with Al-Qaeda, you know, I could be busted for it. You know, and I was even told that I was still a threat to national security because of the things that I learned while I was over there. But now, as me being a truck driver, you know, I've got to, you know, if I'm a threat to national security, yet I've got to pay money to go have my fingerprints done in the whole nine yards, you know. So what's going on with this country? You know, we got transportation specialists coming home from Iraq that have more driving time in a combat situation, being bombed, being shot at, you know, in the whole nine yards, yet have to come back home and have to endure what our people up in government have absolutely no clue about what's going. Have never picked up a rifle in their life, you know, or wearing a tie and pushing a pencil behind some nice little neat marble desk up in Washington, and don't have a clue about what's really going on in life, and especially in the military. You know, so, you know, there's a lot of guys that have come home that I have talked to that are really upset at the fact that, you know, they've got to endure this crap that the federal government is making them have to endure after serving their time in country. You know, there's no reason. You know, there's no reason for this stuff.
Okay, let me ask you something. You had said last night, how do you feel about the war now, and especially the leadership of the Bush administration right now with their drive to stay the course? One thing I keep hearing is their death was not in vain. We must stay to make their death mean something. How do you feel about that?
Well, I'm going to tell you, here's my attitude is that when my battalion commander, my old battalion commander, the 1st Battalion of the 147th Armored Division there in Cincinnati, Ohio, had come down and asked for volunteers, I had immediately raised my hand and was ready to go over and to do something for my country, because I remember that when 9/11 took place, I was driving a truck, my wife and I was up in South Carolina delivering a load, and I can remember the feeling of dread and threat the whole nine yards. And I watched all the way through to the time they bombed Afghanistan and took the Taliban out. I watched Colin Powell go up to the UN and make the case for the weapons of mass destruction and things of this. I watched all that take place, and at that point I was very pro-war. I was ready for it. You know, I was a big Sean Hannity and I was a big fan of Michael Savage and a lot of these major talk shows, because they were part of the Saddam Hussein was doing stuff that wasn't right, and we needed to go in there, and we needed to get him. Well, you know, when I was over there, I remember when they got Saddam Hussein. It was December 13, 2003. I was walking out of the Tactical Operations Center, the very same place that I was being held for 30 days without weapons or with the weapons and ammo unsecured. And they said they caught Saddam Hussein. And I got to thinking to myself, at this point, we've been in country for 7 months. I said, big deal. What's the big deal now? When do we get to go home? And I think it was somewhere in that vicinity that now my viewpoint is this, is that, you know, I believe that Bush has undoubtedly, unequivocally lied to the American people. I believe that his people, such as Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh and all these people, they're pushing his agenda through. We've lost over 2,000 soldiers so far, you know, combat, and we're not seeing any way out of it. I believe without a shadow of a doubt that there needs to be an immediate pullout of Iraq. Bush has said time and time again that when this happens, we'll start pulling the troops out. When this happens, we'll start, you know, when the Constitution gets set up, we'll start looking at pulling the troops out. When Donald Rumsfeld says, you know, well, we'll start doing a troop reduction, you know, well, instead of doing a troop reduction, they do a troop increase from 130,000 people up to 155,000 people. Well, what are we doing over there? Why are you upgrading the troop strength for when they're not doing anything but sitting over there? You know, and I have to take this back. You asked me a question earlier. I personally was doing a job other than what my original MOS was. No, I wasn't, other than the AMP work. But there were units over there that were artillery specialists that were going out and pulling security duty. They were going out and kicking in doors with regular infantry units. There was units that weren't supposed to be going out and doing quartermaster units that were going out and kicking in doors and doing this and doing that because there wasn't nothing for them to do.
I'm running along on time here, but I really got to get this. Right now, with your feelings, how do you feel about the general, you know, the state of it? I mean, you said you believe the troops can be pulled out right away, so you do not think this war has got any purpose right now. You don't see anything positive coming out of it?
No, all they're doing is just spinning their wheels, you know, over and over and over again, and that's all they're doing. You know, Bush has nothing to lose out of this because he's in a second term, so why not keep the soldiers over there until he gets done with the second term, and that way, and that's when everything, you'll start seeing things change.
All right, and this is your chance to say anything that's on your mind to the American people. I mean, go for it. Whatever you feel right now is on your mind.
I'm going to say on my mind is I know there's going to be a lot of people that are going to disagree with what I've said here today, and that's their right. But I want to remind you, you know, that when you go about your day-to-day routine in life, first and foremost, be thankful for the opportunity that you have got to get out and do those things. Be thankful for the fact that you got the opportunity to disagree with me or disagree with somebody else. But, you know, think of the American soldier that is fighting for the rights of you and everybody else that you know, want to disagree. You know, people need to know what the facts are. You need to take the time and get the facts. Take the time and dig and see what's going on. You know, this war is not affecting, it's not affecting very many people other than those that have family members over there that are serving. People are going about their daily lives and they just don't care about what's going on. But the American population needs to care about what's going on. And I'm going to say this, when 9/11 happened, it said, you know, everybody said united we stand. Well, when I was driving a truck, we weren't united. We were never united. You know, when 9/11 took place, we were united. It took two 2 or 3 days or 1 week, you know, said, oh, we're all united, but turns out that we weren't united. But when it comes down to the Americans, when it comes down to this war that we're in right now, you know, we need to bring our boys home. It's time to bring the boys and girls home and you know, put it into the hands of the Iraqi people. They've been fighting for thousands of years. We're never going to change it. There's not a thing that we're going to be able to do to change it. So let them live their lives. Let them do what they've got to do. And bring our boys and girls home. You know, let's stop the bloodshed, stop the needless, stupid stuff, and stop swindling and crying over spilled milk when it comes down to these politics and Democrats and Republicans and whatever else. It's time that we take the time to bring our people home. Stop putting bodies in body bags and burying them in Arlington National Cemetery. That's what I would have to say.
Well, I thank you very much. I'm going to stop the interview now.